In her recent study titled Irish Materialisms, Colleen Taylor tells us that in 18th and 19th century Ireland, rural communities were known to hold spinning parties, which inevitably involved song as the main form of entertainment and would even be attended by men in some cases, as recorded in Henry Coulter's The West of Ireland. Older references to these dialogue-like spinning songs show how they take the form of a confrontational conceit about potential suitors. In reality, Nick Loughlin argues, this confrontation was likely a light-hearted conflict designed for the entertainment of nearby listeners at a spinning party, as if a comic opera. The call and response nature of these matchmaking spinning songs gave occasion for comic retorts that derived their humor from emasculating descriptions of men, what Nick Loughlin calls ritual dispraise, such as descriptions like, he's a walking wisp, he staggers at the knees. Comedy was clearly a function of the communal spinning songs, serving to lighten the labor and relieve the monotony of the work. The ephemerality of these songs, often composed on the spot during the spinning or cloth-making work, other times scripted orally beforehand, gave these spinner composers the security to express comical retorts that otherwise might irreverently and dangerously undermine Irish masculinity. As Galway and Mayo song collector Eileen Costello writes in 1923, the attraction of these humor-spinning songs lay in the fact that they could be insulting with impunity. On a more serious note, many of these cloth-making songs associated the production of yarn and linen with reproduction. The connection between cloth-making songs and rituals of human fertility is of considerable antiquity in the Gaelic traditions of Scotland and Ireland, where there was a direct overlap between making clothes and clothing babies. The song, Cuckoo My Yellow Blackbird, we're hearing here, it's an Irish spinning song associated with Ulster, traceable to both Donegal and Limerick, offering a unique insight into how these spinning songs might also empower women with the license of free sexual expression. The song is a narrative about a young woman forced to marry an old man, and one day comes upon a young, supernatural, golden-haired man with whom she has a sexual encounter. The contrast between the young partner and the old, moral husband, Nick Loughlin writes, is almost certainly an emblem of fertility, while permitting, relatively speaking, some sense of bawdiness that might not otherwise be acceptable in public society, suggesting that such songs were sung for female ears alone. As Nick Loughlin maintains, even when operating in the standard rhythmic formula and matchmaking conceit, Irish female songs could nevertheless make space for some sense of quiet, coded subversion or contained protest, as in the Irish keening and lament tradition, through the themes of emasculating description and female virility. Words of Colleen Taylor in her study, Irish Materialisms. Taylor uses an interesting phrase here, saying these female songs could make space for some sense of quiet, coded subversion or contained protest within their male-dominated society. We're invited to an exhibition at the Allentown Art Museum of works by Angela Fraley, some of which intertwine scenes of women gathering that meld fabric and feminine social space with imagery echoing the communal textile workspaces seen throughout the show and suggesting the subversive conversations, stories, and songs women might share in these contexts. The exhibition is titled Angela Fraley, Threaded with Moonlight, featuring the artist's newest body of work inspired by the Allentown Art Museum's rich textile holdings and the long history of textiles as a medium associated with female labor. Claire McCree, associate curator at the Allentown Art Museum, worked closely with Angela Fraley on the exhibition, and we had a chance to speak by phone with Claire about Threaded with Moonlight.
Angela Fraley is an artist who's based in Allentown as well as New York City. She has her studio just a couple blocks away from the museum, and she's also a professor at Moravian. And in her work, she's really interested in storytelling, and she has a practice of plucking or quoting figures from historical works of art and then creating new settings and environments for these figures, which she recreates in her work, that give them new empowering places and stories.
Tell us something about the extent of the textile collection.
So the museum's textile collection was part of the inspiration for this project with Angela, actually. The collection stretches over 5 continents and 16 centuries. And so it's just an amazingly wide range of traditions from cultures all around the world and from across centuries. And about half of the museum's objects in the collection are textiles, about 8,000 total. So there's just a really such a wealth of material to draw on and be inspired by.
Well then, how did Angela and the collection and you get together to bring about this project?
So Angela works a lot with women and historic gendered social roles and narratives that apply to women. And so with our textile collection, we wondered if she might be interested in doing something that spoke to the museum's collection and the history of women and textiles, since, you know, in many cultures and across time, textile making has been primarily something that has been practiced by women. And so in her work, she was really interested in looking at the idea of textiles as a space for expressing intention or communicating and potentially even harnessing power. So she looked at the history of religious traditions, both in Europe and around the world, where you have female deities who are spinning fiber and determining fate, like the Greek fates, for instance, might be the best known, where one of them is spinning the fiber of the thread, one is measuring the fiber, and then one is cutting it, and that's how the length of someone's life is determined, that the life is created through the spinning. It's determined the lifespan through measuring and then cut for the end of the life. And there are cultures all over the world that have similar beliefs where you have parallel traditions that relate to destiny and the passage of time and human life and spinning, or the idea of weaving, female goddesses weaving, being part of the creation of the world. And so she was looking at that. She was also looking at fairy tales and the presence of spinning and stitching and other textile-related activities and how those intersect with ideas about gender. And then she was also really inspired by the local history of silk mills in this area and thinking about just kind of these different layers of connection.
How did you navigate the collection? Did she tell you these are her interests and then you went into the archives and sought out some examples? How did it work?
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was definitely a challenge. So I knew that she was really interested in traditional motifs that had to do with abundance, protection, blessing, these kinds of designs that are used in different cultures that kind of bear these meanings and intention of goodwill. And so I was looking at those for her and trying to provide a wide range of motifs and traditions and visually, aesthetically distinctive things for her to draw on. And she would reach out to me and say, oh, I'm looking for more things related to gardens, or how about some more lace? And so I sent her a lot of things. I also gave her a chance to look at our catalog and search herself. And so it was definitely a collaboration in terms of locating potential source material for her to draw on and to excerpt in her finished work.
Did she sketch? Was she able to take photographs? You have to worry about the longevity of the fabrics and not exposing them to light. How did that play into her searching?
So she actually worked mostly from our collection photographs, just for ease, simplicity of having the material digitally available. And she actually works a lot with Photoshop, and so having the photo files was really helpful to her in that regard. Yeah, and that's true that we definitely have to be mindful of light exposure for our textile collection, but non-flash photography is okay. So if you're visiting our galleries and want to take a picture of our textiles, just make sure your flash is off.
And she works in a large scale, doesn't she?
Yeah, her paintings are quite large scale, and she created 3 new works for this exhibition that are really wonderful and immersive. They have depictions of the fates, as we talked about before, though also, you know, these could be just everyday women who are doing their daily chores of spinning, and that was just a daily fact of life. And so there's this really fun ambiguity between divine, supernatural power and human, kind of mundane everyday in her work that she intentionally creates. And so these paintings, they're 80 inches tall, and they're hung on a wall that's covered with a silk drape, a silk curtain, which she painted with these kind of botanical motifs inspired by some of the works in the collection. So you have the female figures, they're on this background of motifs drawn from the collection within the painting, and then you also have this silk drape behind them, and it really creates this kind of dramatic experience when you see it in person.
And she seems to love paint, and she seems to love human flesh in a wonderful way. She gives her human figures real heft.
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of life in the figures she paints. And yeah, she really, technically, she's so skilled with oil paint and really being able to, when she's taking these figures from old master paintings, being able to recreate that style in her work. And I think that's one thing that's really exciting and intriguing about her work is this blend between, you know, this very skilled historical painting style of, you know, creating these realistic layers of skin and body, and then combining that with a more contemporary feeling with the bright colors and the kind of surreal, dreamlike landscapes that she creates for these figures to live in.
When she was exploring certain themes, Claire, are there background materials, are there explanatory notes throughout your collection that would be helpful in that way, where you would say, oh, I know, Bali, there's something there?
Yeah, that's definitely, so Angela's practice is very strongly research-informed. She really likes to dig into the historical context for the periods that she's looking at. So both of us did a lot of research and kind of were sharing resources throughout the process to kind of inform that perspective. She really likes to get a sense of that historical world and the traditions that she's drawing on, you know, so that when she is disrupting them in certain ways in her work, she's doing that, you know, in a very informed and thoughtful way. So, yeah, and in terms of our collection, for many of the objects, we do have that kind of information either in the files or in our cataloging. So, yeah, so it definitely being able to share brief snippets about, like, oh, you know, this textile has this imagery and would have been used for a wedding and had protective qualities and fertility and all these wishes associated with it was really helpful.
Because Angela is rooted in the Western tradition of art, she's able to quote from the old masters, say, in her own paintings today. Does she leave it to our own imagination about what she's quoting?
Yeah, I would say in a lot of her work, she's not necessarily quoting very well-known paintings where someone is going to recognize, oh, I know the you know, the female nude or the depiction of Greek goddesses that this comes from. And to her, it's less important necessarily that the viewer know the source or make an effort to understand what the source is. It's much more kind of about knowing the general process that she's going through of you know, rescuing these women from the margins of history or rescuing them from these limited narratives that they've been given. And the focus is really on kind of the new stories, the new possibilities she's created.
You spoke about the pieces that she has created for this show. What else will be on exhibit?
So there are three large paintings and the drape, as we talked about. We have a few large paintings from one of her past projects that dovetailed really well. These are also monumental scale female nudes combined with textile designs by Candace Wheeler, who was a late 19th century female textile designer. So it seems very, you know, had a lot of resonance with these themes. And then she has a series of about 10 studies that are included as well that, you know, explore some tangents within this world of women and textile work. And so these smaller works are on paper and look at characters, some from Greek mythology, like Arachne, who boasted that she could weave better than Athena, the goddess associated with weaving. Athena challenged her to a contest, and Arachne won. Her work was objectively better, but Athena turned Arachne into a spider. And so kind of looking at, you know, traditionally that's seen as a story of pride, but how can we understand it as Arachne being a whistleblower and saying, no, you need to, I'm going to speak truth to power and reveal what's really going on here. So she has a depiction of Arachne that's combined with a 19th century embroidery pattern of a spider web from our collection. The whole idea of taking patterns that were meant for women to replicate, you know, probably designed by men, published in a magazine. Women were supposed to recreate this pattern and then fragmenting it or using it outside of its intended purpose, being really fun. She also has some where she explores different fairy tales like Rumpelstiltskin and Sleeping Beauty, and also a pair that explores the imagery of the Virgin Mary spinning, which was really popular in the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, and then also imagery of the witch and how can textile work be seen as both virtuous and pious, but also something that's subversive and disruptive and potentially related to harnessing supernatural power. One thing that's special about the exhibition as well is that it features Angela's work, but we've also incorporated textiles from the museum collection alongside her work. And so these are works that help to inspire her new works, the textiles. Some of them, you know, you might be able to see these visual parallels between Angie's work and the textile, the historic textile from the collection. And we were also really interested in this idea of, you know, women who are creating textiles, who are stitching and their intentions or their communications, these invitations are embedded in these artifacts, these pieces of fabric. And so this whole concept of making as power and textiles as power, it felt exciting and important to be able to bring more of that into the space and to have all of these different makers' voices together with Angela's to, you know, really to round out the show and really give it a different dimension. And the idea of subversion and disrupting expectations of what this kind of meek femininity associated with textiles, thinking about a different story, that's all very central to the exhibition.
Now, Claire, you will have a dialogue with Angela. Tell us what we can see and take part in as the exhibit continues.
Yeah, so on Saturday, March 23rd, Angela and I are going to be in conversation, in a dynamic conversation program at the museum. That's at 1 p.m. on that date. We'll be exploring her work, kind of her process, and how she gets from the research to the source materials to creating a composition and thinking about, you know, a lot of just this really complex history and research that underlies a lot of her work. It's really a pleasure to hear her speak because she thinks so deeply about the stories that she's telling, and there's so much that goes into every decision when she's working. So it's really a joy to kind of explore that more deeply.
And how long will the show run?
The show is on view through April 21st. So just a reminder that admission at the museum is always free. We're open Thursday through Sunday, and we have free parking as well. And, yeah, when you visit, you should also make sure to check out. We have an exhibition called Nostalgia for My Island that comes to us from the Ponce Museum in Puerto Rico. And that focuses on the development of a Puerto Rican painting tradition from about 1900 to 1960. And it's just a really wonderful show and fascinating to see kind of these dialogues between artists in that era. And the other exhibition on view right now is the making of Gustav Bauman's El Velorio, The Wake, which looks at the process of making a color woodblock print. And we have, in this show, we show the actual woodblocks as well as proofs of each color that was eventually layered into making one print. And so it's a really great way to see that aspect of printmaking, which is often kind of mysterious. You see the finished print, but you don't know. It's hard to visualize how all of those colors and forms came together through the printing process. So both of those are great to check out the next time you're at the museum.
Claire McCree, Associate Curator at the Allentown Art Museum, speaking about the exhibition Angela Fraley, Threaded with Moonlight, running now through April 21st. Admission to the Allentown Art Museum is free for all, always. Parking in the museum's lot is also free. Hours are Thursdays through Sundays, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., and the third Thursday, 11 a.m. to 8 p.m. For more information on the web, allentownartmuseum.org, allentownartmuseum.org. Saturday, March 16th, at 1 o'clock, there will be a free guided tour of the exhibition. And then on Saturday, March 23rd, as we heard, a dynamic conversation with Claire McCree and Angela Fraley. That's also free and at 1 o'clock. For more information, allentownartmuseum.org. It's Angela Fraley, Threaded with Moonlight. And Fraley is spelled F-R-A-L-E-I-G-H. Angela Fraley, Threaded with Moonlight at the Allentown Art Museum through April 21st.